Hey, folks, yes, it's tis the season to be jolly. Fa-la-la-la-la-la-la. Yes, the Man of Steel, Michael Steele. Welcome to the Man of Steel podcast. Such a pleasure having you be along for the ride this holiday season. Of course, you know, I'll just put it up front. You can still follow us on Twitter at Michael Steele. You can catch the Man of Steel podcast on Stitcher and Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm excited about ending the year with someone I like to call a buddy. I've known her a long time. She is one of the stalwarts, if you will, in conservative thinking and philosophy, for sure, but also bringing a broader perspective on a whole host of issues. She's an associate editor and columnist at Real Clear Politics. She has covered the U.S. Congress since 1994 for State News Service, the Hill newspaper, and as a Senate producer for ABC News. She's just a solid lady, good people to end the year with. A.B. Stoddard, folks. We just call her A.B. Welcome to the Man of Steel podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. I'm excited to join you.
Yeah, well, you know, it's exciting stuff going on. I mean, what a hell of a way to end the year with the resignation of the Secretary of Defense, the president doing the throwdown on the wall, border wall, and shutting down the government. You've got Russia and Turkey and all of these folks at play. How would you assess where the United States of America is? We the people, where are we as we end 2018?
Well, Michael, it's been a very bad couple of days, and it's happened very rapidly. A lot of market reaction to just sort of general fears and increase in a spike in interest rates, and then nervous about the shutdown, all happening at the same time that on Wednesday the president announces he's pulling out of Syria, saying that we won, which is something in the age of terror no one is ever supposed to say.
Right.
And then within 36 hours after that, saying he's pulling out of Afghanistan. So it was a very, very turbulent week. And it's not over, of course. And I think that what I noted in all of the smoke and the storm clouds was, for the first time, and I'm sure you noted as well, Republicans coming out and forcefully criticizing the president.
Right.
on this withdrawal from Syria. That was Wednesday, Thursday. Today, I'm telling you this. There's an actual Associated Press report out on it's like a TikTok of President Trump's phone call with Turkish President Erdogan last Friday, which set this all in motion, where he disregarded talking points and basically just went kind of haywire and was kind of almost baited into this decision by Erdogan, who then was so stunned that he said, well, don't leave Syria too quickly. But I think that this strong reaction from the Republican Party is indicative of the fact that they've waited till after the midterms elections to sort of feel freer to criticize the president. They're very concerned about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi,
right,
the journalist that was murdered in Istanbul by the Saudis. And so I just noticed that is a shift, that as this terrible news about James Mattis sinks in into the Christmas week and beyond, and they have to start thinking about what kind of a person will replace him, what qualified, you know, individual would want to step into these kind of rotten shoes and be treated this way and carry out this kind of policy. I do want to feel hopeful that Republicans are going to take a stronger hand as a co-equal branch of government and the Congress in really getting involved in these national security debates and decisions and the choice of our next defense secretary. I just have to hope that that's what we're going to see as a result of this, because there is genuine fear around the world and across the country, and Republicans are admitting it to you and me privately, about what the ramifications are of these withdrawals and then the Mattis departure. Genuine fear.
You put your finger so appropriately on the two words that I think define this period, genuine fear. I just spent a week in Qatar and at a forum. Yes, it was slanted, and the Russians came and did their propaganda BS and all of that. But when you're having the sidebar conversation with business leaders, diplomats, and even, you know, political and governmental officials, they are the first question out of their mouth is, what the hell is going on? The second is, what the hell is going to happen? And
right.
and on the news of the Mattis departure, impending departure, really sent alarm bells off, set them off across capitals globally. And here's my push on all of this at this point. Donald Trump has taken us into a space where Donald Trump wants us to be because it's a space he can control. Only he knows the outcome because there is no outcome that's predefined. So for him, it's a momentary. So whatever happens in the moment, I'm going to use events. I'm going to use people to offset what I consider to be bad news. The trigger for this current period is the acceleration of activity by the Mueller probe. The fall of Cohen, the fall of Flynn, the judge looking at Michael Flynn and going, "You, sir, are a traitor." He effectively said that, right? Even asking the prosecutor, "Is there any way we can charge him with treason?" Effectively, right? So Trump is looking at all this. He's going, "Oh hell, we need to change the conversation." And here we are. We're suddenly now pulling out of Afghanistan with no rhyme or reason. Now, I've been advocating being out of Afghanistan going back to when I was RNC chairman, got a boatload of crap for the position I took as a national chairman on and questioning why we were in Afghanistan. But even then, my argument was we need to get out, but we need to get out in season. In other words, you just don't jump out because you don't want to be there. You leave with a plan. You leave with a strategy, something in place working with our allies, something in place working with support on the ground. You just don't go. You don't make these rash decisions. This president has always been about the rash decision, AB.
Yeah, and he really, it literally doesn't occur to him. When he got off the phone with Erdogan and then wanted to speak with Netanyahu, he had a concern about that relationship. But it doesn't occur to him that we owe the Kurds something, that they would have to release thousands of ISIL prisoners in order to fend off an assault coming from Turkey and release the prisoners back to the regime of Bashar al-Assad, because they don't have the manpower, because we were backing them up, to continue to keep these ISIL fighters contained. And so it's just none of this crosses his mind, and it's not of any concern. And I mean, when you talk about these conversations overseas, it's just terrifying, because, you know, we had John McCain do a world tour after Trump was inaugurated, literally a world tour to assure everybody. That was the role of James Mattis ever since.
Right.
And it is it's really remarkable to have a discussion about the fact that Mattis's departure resulted from the fact that he no longer believed the president's policies. They don't reflect our values, that he doesn't respect coalitions and alliances, and that he now is going to have to search for a Secretary of Defense who is he going to get to serve who would just abandon the Kurds? So it's, you know, all these questions about how we stay strong, how we safeguard our long-term security. I mean, I just don't know where the Republican Party goes with this, Michael. I hope that they're going to get involved, and I hope that they're going to be firm. But we won't find the right leader unless that person get support from enough vocal Republicans that we need to go back to the Mattis way.
Well, you just begged the question. So where does the GOP go? How does the GOP respond to this decision to pull out of Syria and begin the drawdown in Afghanistan? There is, as you aptly noted, no John McCain there. I don't know how to trust Senator Lindsey Graham anymore, because he's too, how shall I put it politely?
It's very capricious. Yeah, it goes up and down.
Yeah, it's
and,
a little fluid, just a little bit fluid. You know, I like calm waters, and I get the fluidity. You want to have that flexibility, but there's beneath the surface of those waters are supposedly some firm grounds. So I'd like to see more of that. So I don't know where they go. And quite honestly, I don't think they know where they go because they don't want to be on the wrong side of Trump, wherever the hell that is, because you know it shifts. So it doesn't matter. So I think this is, I hate using hyperbole, but I think it's particularly the way it came about. These events represent dangerous moments without clarity, without definition otherwise. And that definition and clarity certainly has to come from the next Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, whom, by the way, I think if we look at the other replacements, could largely wind up being a flacky lackey for the president to just kind of be the yes man puppet on whatever his moment is. And I certainly don't see that coming from the GOP, where they go in and say, Mr. President, no, this is not the way we should be conducting the nation's foreign policy. But I don't see that. So.
Well, like I said, I'm sort of what in my initial remarks, my hope, and it might be,
it's that Christmas,
you know, it might be
Christmas
a fever
spirit.
Fantasy, but my hope is that this has become so dire that more people will. I mean, credible people are asking on Twitter this week whether or not the president is a Russian agent, because Vladimir Putin got like 3 Christmas goodies in a week. You know, Deripaska sanctions relieved. You know, the Syria thing, Afghanistan, all this stuff, and so. I think that because it's so dire, and because there is a serious question about how much he's emboldening the Iranians and the Russians, that the Republicans will have to step up and get in his way and dictate the terms of the choice of the next Secretary of Defense. This kind of thing. Again, I might be giving them too much credit. They might be still consumed with fear, but I just feel like if you look at what's happened with the pushback against the Saudi crown prince and then followed by this, I don't know that they can just let up. I mean, the Democratic House, whether these Republican senators, you know, that we're sort of putting up on this pedestal, we hope, whether we want to hide under a table or not, the Republican House is going to look into whether or not the Trump Towers in Istanbul are still, you know, producing receipts for President Trump. And revenue, what the Saudi kingdom has on Trump, what Erdogan might know that the Saudi kingdom has on Trump, what Jared Kushner and the crown prince talk about on their WhatsApp deleted offline conversations. I mean, there is a lot that can be turned up, which will put pressure on Republicans, not just on, I mean, Trump, you know, doesn't care what anyone comes up with. But I think it'll make life hard for John Cornyn, who's in cycle, hard for Mitch McConnell, who's in cycle, hard for Cory Gardner, who's in cycle from Colorado, hard for Joni Ernst in Iowa, which is, yes, a state Republican in this election, but, like, how about the soybean farmers? There's a lot of unrest among Republicans in Iowa.
Right.
Look at North Carolina. And, you know, it's not that Tom Tillis can't win, but it's certainly a place for Democrats to play.
Absolutely.
Right? And
absolutely.
So if you're those people and come April, the Democrats in the House are turning up, we're in real national security crises, the kind that the Republicans can't really defend, and they're running out of things to say, and Lindsey Graham is still, I don't know, on a high horse, and then they're turning up this stuff. There are going to be real questions about, you know, whether or not they have to kind of step up. And of course, I also like to think that, you know, maybe they're getting calls from Jimmy Carter and George W. Bush and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and people who matter, saying it's time for you to step up. And what if Mike Pence picks up the phone? And, you know, I know he speaks regularly with Joe Biden. It's not beyond the imagination, Michael, that like this is really a 4-alarm fire.
No, I agree with that very much. And I do agree and appreciate the fact that the former Republican President Bush does reach out and tries to have those back channel conversations, as do other former Bush administration officials, not pushing Bushism, but just saying dude, how can we help, you know, move this thing away from the cliff that you are currently standing on? And how can we give you support to find a friggin' backbone for once? Although I'm not putting these words in the president's mouth. That was Michael Still's editorial comment. You know, that's how I look at it. I mean, I just want someone to go into that room with the president. And Mattis was that guy, for sure. We'd hoped John Kelly was that guy. And say, you know, no, this is how
I'm going. Very concerned about Mike Pompeo, because Mike Pompeo, who I used to respect, is, I know he was part of this threesome over the weekend after the Erdogan call into Monday and Tuesday. He and Bolton and Mattis, all three, came to try to stop or slow this decision on Monday.
Yep.
They were told by John Kelly, I'm sorry, the guy's not going to listen to you. Nothing you can do here. And then they tried it again on Tuesday, and then, of course, Mattis resigned. So it does leave a few eyes on Bolton and Pompeo, right? At some point, are they going to get calls from George W. Bush? I mean, at some point, is there something that they can do to put the country before Trump's tantrums?
And
impulsive whims? I mean...
I doubt it, to be honest. I raised two boys. I know what a 10-year-old acts like when he doesn't get his way. And I'm just telling you, that's what you're dealing with here. You know, the throwing stuff around, the pouting, the sitting there with the arms crossed, with the stern face. And
I know, but my attitude is, even Mike Pence, you know, in his servitude, knows that if Donald Trump intended to be a St. Bernard puppy and drool all over the room and knock the furniture over, he should have stayed in business.
Yeah, right.
And he can't lead the free world this way. And so at some point, I'm hoping, you know, that Pompeo and Bolton and Pence are sitting around in a room saying, like, did they let the country just teeter off the cliff? I just don't. I don't care. I was just talking to a former senator a few hours ago. We can't count on Trump, Michael.
No, we can't.
We can't count on him to change his mind or calm down. We can only count on the people around him.
That's it. Well, but the people around him, he's not listening to. He's listening to Rush Limbaugh and others. They're the ones setting foreign policy for the United States right now based on some really effed up view of the world. But that's okay. I get it. You play where you want to play. I think we need to be mindful of what the outgoing Secretary of Defense said to the president in his departure notice. Quote, my views on treating allies with respect and also being clear-eyed about both malign actors and strategic competitors are strongly held and informed by over four decades of immersion in these issues. That is the street cred of someone who knows the dangers of what we're dealing with versus the man who says, I'm smarter than my generals. Clearly not. So we'll just leave that there for what it is. And I think all of us now need to pay a little bit more attention to exactly how these dominoes are starting to fall, not just here in this country, but globally, because it will have an impact. The other thing I want to get into with you, though, is while this and this story is like many others, it's competing. It's competing with the president's other decision that we're now sort of waiting in with the House and the Senate, especially in play, shutting down the federal government. The president made it very clear again, talking to, I guess, his base as opposed to the ministers of his administration who are charged with the responsibility of helping the president craft the kind of legislation that can get through the Senate to and the House to keep the government going. At this point, shutdown's a 50-50 call, I guess, at this point. You think now, you know, as we're talking here, the Senate is sort of roiling about trying to figure out what it wants to do. But Midnight Friday is the game, and what's your assessment there?
You know, I'm with you, Michael, and I think he hurls shiny objects around to deflect away from things.
Yep.
And he doesn't want us talking about Mattis. And he sent Sarah Sanders out in the rain on Friday morning to basically say that it was like a media-driven, controversy or something.
Right.
And that we were all imagining its actual significance and consequence. So I do think that the shutdown, he believes, is like a great thing to just sort of smother everything else out. It was very impressive, I must say, that the House rounded up 70 bodies, people who had gone home, forced them back, and they were able to pass this last night. I'm very impressed. And that gave the president a shot in the arm. It doesn't mean that he's going to get Democrats. He had Republican senators over to the White House. That doesn't get you Democrats. So he got to talk to them about the steel slats and the nuclear option, and apparently the meeting didn't go very well.
Right.
And he's just trying to drive them completely over the edge.
But I do believe it's going
to result in a shutdown, because I don't think a compromise would either involve a DACA deal, which he's turned down before because Stephen Miller told him to, his immigration guru, or legislation to protect Bob Mueller. And I don't see him agreeing to either. And wouldn't you think those would be the buckets for compromise?
Well, of course they're the buckets for compromise. And on the DACA piece, that's something that Trump himself had agreed to prior to when the number was $20 billion. The Dems said, okay, we'll give you, for a DACA fix, we'll give you $20 billion for a wall. Trump walked away from that deal because, again, his most right flank started to balk, just as we saw that same right flank start to balk in the last 24 to 36 hours when it looked like he was prepared to
walk away
from the deal. So we're clear what we're talking about, folks. We're not talking about a border wall per se. We're talking, what did he call it? Aluminum siding? No, what?
Steel slat.
Yeah, right. Steel.
I like aluminum siding, but yeah, it's kind of like, I want to see it at the next rally. What do we want? Steel slats. Who's going to pay for it? Maybe a slush funded HUD.
Yeah, a slush funded HUD or Home Depot. One of the two. One of the steel slats brought to you by Home Depot. So this is what we've come to here. And, you know, it's just one of those things that it drives me nuts again, where Republicans at one point were really in a leadership position going back to the Bush administration in sort of laying down some new tracks. Everyone in the country, and let's just, I think, stop the crying game about, oh, you know, Dems don't want border security, or these types of Republicans don't want border security. You know, I call BS on that, because everyone understands at the core this is about the sovereignty of a nation. And so, yes, we want our borders secure. How you do that, the means you use to do that, is what matters. And so it's not just throwing up aluminum siding and putting up slats. It's about technology. It's about personnel. It is about on-the-ground information. But you know what it's also about, AB, and I'd love to get your thinking on this. It's about a relationship with Mexico. It's about talking to the leaders in Mexico and saying, hey, let's create an economic zone along our border where we both benefit, number one. So we don't have to worry about folks pouring over in tough times in Mexico, or even American business flowing there when it's tough times here. Let's talk about that. And two, let's talk about your southern border, where in combination of effort between the United States government and the Mexican government, we can deal with the outflow from the south, from those countries that are having refugees and migrants move away from harsh conditions and crime and bad regimes. But we can't have that conversation.
No, he doesn't do things in increments. He doesn't do things in coalitions. Everything is about winning or losing. And so everything is, everything's polar. It's one thing or the other. And so I actually don't think he wants the wall. I think he wants to talk about the wall until November of 2020. Because if he gets the wall, then what can he,
what are you talking about?
As Newt Gingrich once said of him, and I often remind my Republican friends of this who support President Trump, Donald Trump wakes up every morning thinking about how he can stay on offense.
Yes.
It's not really about resolution.
Right.
It's really about fighting. and looking strong in his view. And so the idea of like incrementally putting time, energy, diplomacy, and resources into what you suggest, which is to mitigate the long-term threat, and to do the hard work of the relationship at the border, combined with some kind of really sensible and effective border security that isn't the wall, is just too gray area for him. And what's so interesting about this fight is that, well, they just unearthed comments from Mick Mulvaney from 2015 right. saying the wall is simplistic and childish. But right. but really, border state Republicans have never been for a wall. And
no.
I trust border state Republicans to know this issue the best.
Yes.
And so that's really a tough one. And I think if he was out there, you know, this is an issue that requires presidential leadership. And so when you talk about him walking away from that DACA deal, he took four positions on the Congressman Goodlatte bill.
Yeah.
His Freedom Caucus people balked when he wanted to do a DACA deal and said it was amnesty. He gets freaked out by right-wing radio. And then when he came up with his consensus plan, it got the fewest votes when it went on the Senate floor than any of the proposals.
Right.
So if you look at all those factors, you think, you know what? It requires skin in the game. And so it's something he just time and again refuses to do. On healthcare, he wanted everyone to work it out. He had promised the public everything on healthcare. Your own doctor, government
right.
subsidies, everything was going to be cheap.
Right.
Everything was going to be the best. And they ended up with nothing, which is why he lost some of his own voters in this election, because I think it's the Trump women voters
uh-huh.
who said, my husbands go to rallies. They're still mad at NFL players, and they're really afraid of the caravan. But I've looked at my economic situation 2 years later. They didn't give me new health care. I didn't get the benefits of that tax cut. The factory didn't come back to my town.
Right.
And my farming friends are suffering. There's no plan. And they might not have voted for Democrats, but they stayed home. And so this whole idea that like the Democrats are supposed to back down after they've tried to work with him in the past, but he has to come to the middle on this issue and give something to get something. It's just not, it's not an, anyway, the idea that he can sort of just bulldoze them into this issue after all the fails we saw on immigration in the last year and a half is laughable.
So
the time to do this wasn't December 20th.
No, of course not. But it worked for his timetable because, again, he
changes the subject.
It changes the subject. And he's all about deconstructing the administrative state as best as he can. And for him, that goes exactly what you were just saying, to creating the kind of, you know, offense 24/7 at every the moment there's a lull where there looks like there's about to be resolution, he will find a reason not to resolve the problem.
And which is why he took four positions on the Goodlatte bill.
Which is why he took four positions on the Goodlatte bill, exactly. And which is why 6 weeks ago, he started threatening about shutting down the government because they were working towards a resolution, which is when they found a resolution, the president, what did he say? I just won't sign the bill. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. You mean your White House was not in communication with the Senate staff and the House staff when all of these negotiations were going on and coming to the resolution to avoid a government shutdown? And now
not that Vice President Pence doesn't deserve it, but he did go to the Senate 2 days ago and assure the senators
that
the president would sign it.
That's what I'm saying. Exactly. So here we are. Here we are. So real quick on this. This is one of my favorite parts of this whole psycho blab babble drama thing going on with Trump, and why he's so much like a petulant 10-year-old is when he's out there saying, I want, and I'm not going to do it if you don't let me get my way. But then he changes up and he starts blaming the other guy. So if we go back to that December 10th, I think it's 10th or 11th, in the Oval Office with Nancy and Chuck, and he and Chuck got into it. Let's play a little clip from that where the president does the double dog dare you throw down with Chuck Schuster and says, I will take control of this shutdown.
The one thing I think we can agree on is we shouldn't shut down the government over a dispute. And you want to shut it down. You keep talking about it.
The last time, Chuck, you shut it down.
No.
And then you opened it up very quickly. And
20 times.
I don't want to do what you did.
20 times, Chuck, you have called for, I will shut down the government if I don't get my wool. None of us have
said. You want to know something?
You've said it.
Okay, you want to put that on my...
You said it.
I'll take it.
Okay, good.
You know what I'll say? Yes. If we don't get what we want, one way or the other, whether it's through you, through a military, through anything you want to call, I will shut down the government.
Okay,
absolutely.
Fair enough.
And I am proud, and I'll
we
tell
disagree.
You what, I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck, because the people of this country don't want criminals and people that have lots of problems and drugs pouring into our country. So I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it. The last time you shut it down, it didn't work. I will take the mantle
good.
Of shutting down. And I'm going to shut it down for border security.
But we
security.
Believe you shouldn't okay. shut it down.
Thank you very much, everybody.
So here you have the president saying that I will own this. I will own this shutdown. And what does he tweet this morning? Well, if the government shuts down, the Democrats own the shutdown. I just started laughing. I was like, this is so Trump. It is so Trump.
It's so great. It doesn't matter if there's tape. That's the thing about him. He makes his own reality.
Yes.
And I saw a really incredible tweet today from President Trump from 2013, November 8th, 3 years to the day before he was elected president. It said something to this effect. Leadership means that you have to take responsibility for what you do. Even when you didn't do it, you have to take responsibility. So he was busting on Obama over, I think at the time it was the meltdown of the Obamacare website.
Right.
It was, you know, so he was kicking him when he was down. But the amazing thing is that he invited the cameras into the Oval Office, and then he said to Chuck and Nancy, I will not blame you. And so they have this commercial that they've already put it on Twitter. They've got, they're rolling the tape where he says, I will take the mantle and I will not blame it on you. So that they're going to roll that for the next 3 weeks
of
or
course.
However long he keeps the government shut because he, and Karl Rove is even on the record now in the last day or so saying that was a mistake for him to bring the cameras in because no matter, because he denies the reality of tape, but the rest of us don't.
Right. Right. And the thing about all of that with the tape, and you, again, make the point, he generally doesn't care. That's part of the drama. That's the shtick. That's the radio. That's the reality TV part of his presidency that he wants to make sure stays out there. It, you know, Democrats that I talked to were upset with Nancy and Chuck because they thought they got played to a certain extent and should have anticipated or at least made it very clear they didn't want to have a public meeting with the president with the video cameras running like that. And even Nancy at one point was like, do you really want to do this on camera? My attitude was, why does it matter? He's giving you everything you need right there. If you know what to do with it, then do what you need to do with it. But he's giving it to you because for him, that's part of the reality TV presidency that he's president of, and so he's very fine with it. For him, it was a, you know, he probably looked, the ratings were super. So what does it matter?
You can see in those, some of the most famous meetings, moments of his presidency is when he's brought those cameras in for those meetings where he says it's going to be a bill of love, where at one point he said, I'll take the guns first.
Right.
Remember? And
right.
like he was like lashed out by Tucker Carlson as a gun grabber that night on Fox. I mean, he has really stepped in it when the cameras are rolling. But in the moment, he's just caught up in the excitement of commanding the TV show. And he can't resist that. He just loves that.
Well, I got one more before we boot out of here and get ready to party into the Christmas holiday and the new year. And that is when we turn the corner into a new year, there will be a whole lot of donkeys lined up at a starting gate for the presidential race. What is your early handicapping of the Democratic primary process in terms of some of the early leads out of that starting gate and probably one or two who won't get off the gate at all?
Right. I'm so glad you asked me this question because I wrote a piece that's still up on Real Clear, politics. My best advice for the Democrats, the best shot they have, is to run Biden-Beto as a ticket. And the reason is that Joe Biden is the only Democrat who will get Republicans. You know them, and I know them.
Yep.
Everyone else, they will not vote for Trump, but they will stay home, and they will not vote.
Right.
And Beto has a cult following. Beto, he can, with 2.6% loss in Texas to Ted Cruz, he registered and excited so many new and lapsed voters. It's the lowest voter turnout in the country is Texas. So it's a laboratory for this kind of a movement. And he can bring to the ticket 38 electoral votes from Texas. I absolutely believe it's possible. He has a nationwide following. People go crazy for him. He's good at not talking about Trump and not taking the bait. And I think that it would implicit in the choice would be that Biden gets us through a transition period.
Yep.
Healing alliances around the world, cleaning up the mess, and then passes the baton 4 years later to the junior that he trained to be ready for this job. And then he steps down, you know, and goes back to his grandchildren. And I, you know, the reaction I've gotten, of course, Michael, has been, AB, two white dudes, you're crazy.
I know.
But I'm not saying it's their only shot. I'm saying it's their best shot. If they don't want to screw it up, this is their best shot. Now, the argument they make to me, the players, I talked to big Democrats for this piece, was the only time that we've won the Electoral College twice was with Barack Obama. Very good point. Hillary didn't get it done.
Yep.
Al Gore didn't get it done. I got it. And John Kerry didn't get it done. I got it. But and so you run a black woman, you get the black women. They think it's the practical path to math. I get that. I think that it's not the time for that.
Nope.
We're in a crisis, and we need a calm transition, and we need someone who can win the Rust Belt. As you know, Joe Biden is a deeply faithful Catholic, and go to those people and say, I know why you stopped voting for Obama. You know, you voted for Obama, then you voted for Trump, but hear me out. He's screwing you guys in rural areas. Agriculture needs to come back. You know, let's talk about retraining. Whatever he wants to talk about, they're going to listen, and he's going to have an audience with them. And so I just feel that that's the foolproof way. I think Elizabeth Warren shouldn't even think about running.
I'm completely serious.
I think she is nothing but a scold. That whole video episode was a disaster.
Yeah.
And she's going to become an easy punching bag, and she's going to embarrass herself. She should stay in the Senate and burnish her reputation. Bernie Sanders, very threatened by O'Rourke. There's a lot of backstabbing in the press. Bernie Sanders people are trying to get a lot of like trash talk about Beto, you know, around in every story that they can. You can tell that Bernie really thought he was going to run, and didn't understand that this Beto thing was going to happen. And I think it's going to be Beto's a threat to everybody. He freezes the field because the donors are like, call me when Beto gets in.
Right.
I'm excited about him. And I don't want to give Kamala Harris some money right now. I want to wait and I want to see. So it was a lot of wait and see, and there's too many people. And I suggest that youngsters like Tim Ryan of Ohio and other people who, you know, have a chance later on, just ride this period out, man. Run in 2028 or 32. You know, just ride the tumult out and don't go up. And someone made a very good point to me, which you'll appreciate. If you're Eric Swalwell, been on TV three times a day for the last 8 months talking about the House Intel investigation into Russia, you've got a huge profile. The minute you're a candidate,
it changes.
They don't have you back on.
No, they
don't.
You
just disappear into obscurity.
You do.
With your corporate responsibility event in Iowa that no one attends and gets no coverage, and Trump will make sure that none of the Democrats get any coverage.
And that was very true. I love your ticket. I think it's eminently doable, particularly the Biden piece. The jury's still out for me on Beto. From what I'm hearing in Texas from both Dems and Republicans regarding his ability to take a punch, which he's not had happen to him, and how he deals with the real rustle and tussle of a campaign, which didn't occur in this Texas race. They kind of kept their distances. That's not going to happen with Trump at all. So it'll be interesting to see how he survives that gauntlet to be on the ticket, particularly in the face of some other really attractive candidates like an Amy Klobuchar as a number two, for example.
I understand. I think that she is a strong contender.
Yeah.
But I want to make one point, which is that Beto knocked off an incumbent, Sylvester Reyes, that was backed by President Obama in 2012. He's actually been down in the dirt.
Right.
To some capacity. He didn't just, you know, waltz.
Yeah, he didn't. He didn't just show up. Right.
His El Paso seat. So he's actually been to the map before. And that makes, you know, that at least is part of it. And again, look, I mean, if enough, this is the invisible primary period, right? Like, if enough people go out and say, and get behind him and build a juggernaut, that just, you know, that makes his
inevitability.
It makes you know what it says. It's because a lot of people are telling me, Michael, it's going to go on till May. It's going to be a very long, brutal primary,
right?
And no one's going to come through unscathed. And you make a good point.
Yeah.
But if there is a juggernaut, that will certainly be a buffer. You know, it'll buttress him.
It'll buttress him for sure. All right, she's A.B. Stoddard, folks. You see her on TV. I love it when we get a chance to be on air together. And I certainly follow her work over at Real Clear Politics. She's also covered U.S. Congress since 1994, so she knows of what she speaks when she talks about the throwdowns on the Hill. A.B., such a real pleasure having you with the Man of Steel today. Absolutely.
Oh, Michael, Merry Christmas, Man of Steel. It was a pleasure.
It was a pleasure. Merry Christmas to you and yours. Hey, guys, it's the holiday season, and we're all thinking about giving and sharing. Sometimes the best gift that you can give is an opportunity that could change someone's life. That's why our friends at Transatlantic Real Estate have created an investment opportunity for the everyday investor. Here's the deal. We all know that legal marijuana has created one of the fastest growing industries in this country. We also know that crowdfunding makes it easy to get in early on an investment opportunity. MarijuanaStock.org combines the two. They buy land that supports marijuana grow operations and leases it to licensed high-paying tenants, so you can invest in the landlord of a licensed marijuana farm in a high-growth market. Act now and you can participate for as little as $300 before the company goes public. Just go to MarijuanaStock.org to complete and confirm your application to participate. Don't just buy a gift this holiday season. Get an investment opportunity for someone special. To get started, go to MarijuanaStock.org. That's MarijuanaStock.org. So, all right, folks, that does it for this time. But you know we're coming back because you love me and I love you. This is the Man of Steel podcast. More a little bit later.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.